You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.
The Lung Association of Canada is calling for universally accessible smoking cessation supports for all smokers living in Canada. This recommendation is based on the results of its new report entitled Making Quit Happen, Canada's Challenges to Smoking Cessation. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Anthony Durzo, family physician and director of Primary Care Lung Clinic in Toronto, Ontario. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Barry.
How many Canadians smoke, and what are the demographics in terms of the ages? Are we seeing more young people smoking less or more? What are we seeing in terms of our population?
You know, I think that the challenges with regards to smoking, Barry, relate to, number one, the prevalence. At the present time, about 19% of Canadians, or approximately 5 million people, smoke. That's a high number, but interestingly enough, over the years, that's actually dropped. So I think we're going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the teenage population appears to be a favorite target group for advertisers involved in promoting tobacco. And in fact, the federal tobacco control strategy, one of its mandates is to reduce the number of smokers in the ages of 15 to 17, because that seems to be a very vulnerable group.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of demographics, I mean, it's split down pretty much 50-50. There are concerns that young females are often targets, particularly with respect to how smoking is, portrayed as a fairly glamorous thing to do among young teenage girls.
What is the overall cost to our healthcare system if you have 5 million people smoking and then the subsequent diseases that happen because of that?
You know, if you look at the actual costs, I mean, we're talking billions of dollars. You know, in 2002, tobacco use accounted for about $4.4 billion in direct health costs, and an additional $12.5 billion in indirect costs, such as, loss of productivity.
It's, mm-hmm.
It is quite large, and I think that's certainly a kind of a very simple, objective way to look at the effect. But I think when you look at it from a personal level, when you look at things at the contribution to cardiovascular disease, the contribution to cancer, and if we look at, for example, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, as a physician, you're probably aware of the fact that
mm-hmm.
Of all the chronic diseases that you and I manage, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is the only one whose prevalence continues to increase,
right.
The only one where mortality has still has a very steep ascending direction. And what's particularly troubling about COPD is that it used to be a disease of men, and it has now become a disease of women. So when we look at it in present day, it's about the fourth most common cause of death. In about 15 years or thereabouts, it's going to be the third leading cause
mm-hmm.
of death. And when we look at the human and economic costs just of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, it's going to be staggering.
And I think people aren't aware of what actually happens to them when they get COPD. They hear about COPD, but they don't see it per se.
You know what? I think one of the wonderful things that our Lung Association has been able to do over the years and in its work to get the public to understand
mm-hmm.
And become familiar with the term chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. And some other surveys that they have done have indicated that, in fact, our public has now become more familiar with COPD. The biggest challenge in terms of COPD for patients and physicians is that it's such an insidious disease.
Mm-hmm.
It evolves very slowly, very benignly initially, and by the time you and I see them, unfortunately, most of them have very advanced disease. And so there's a tremendous emphasis on identifying patients who smoke, who consume tobacco in a significant amount, and getting them access to healthcare products that are proven to reduce the need or the cravings for nicotine. And in the end, hopefully, get them off cigarettes altogether. I mean, in many ways, for you and I who deal with it day to day, it seems like a pretty easy no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, though, is nicotine, as you know, ranks among some of the highest addictive substances. And so patients need help. They need medical interventions that have been shown to reduce that craving, to reduce the withdrawal challenges that they face. And unfortunately, as you know, at the present time, most public and private health insurance plans don't cover therapies that are directed at reducing the exposure of patients to nicotine, to nicotine, which is addictive, but to the more harmful elements of cigarette smoke.
Yeah, it seems a very short-sighted policy when you consider the end result of years of smoking will create not only the diseases that the person will end up suffering with and the quality of life diminution, but also the cost of treating the end stages of these diseases as opposed to the cost of actually using the tools that you have available to help them stop. It's a pittance compared to what's down the line.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, for those of us who see these people day in and day out, it truly is a devastating insult on their well-being. I often think that, I say to many of my COPD patients, you know, before they develop chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or at a time when it's still early, I blatantly say to them, you know, you really don't want to get COPD because it is so debilitating in so many different ways that many of my patients, many of my more severe patients, have often said to me they would rather be dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so it certainly does, as you've indicated, have a profound impact, and our approach to it at the present time, certainly from providing support for therapies that are effective, does appear to be a little bit short-sighted because the long-term consequences, if they're allowed to evolve, are very significant, and not only in terms of cost, economic cost, but more importantly, these unfortunate individuals end up in many cases becoming housebound because mm-hmm. they're so disabled. And it really is not a nice thing to have to go through. Many of them, believe it or not, have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease as their only underlying disease. And many of them will survive for significant periods, but at the expense of a very, very poor quality of life.
Now, the report mentioned some bottlenecks to providing smoking cessation services. What were some of the areas that the report showed needed more attention?
You know, the report I thought was very good. It touched on a number of areas that I think are important from a practical standpoint. There are a number of things. Number one, access to medication, as we've already alluded to. Family doctors who are the gatekeepers of the healthcare system, who are I believe, one of the hardest working groups in the healthcare system because they're often having to deal with patient care, administration, all kinds of other things that are often peripheral to the direct patient management. But the biggest challenge family doctors face and other primary caregivers face is that many of us have never been formally trained in addiction medicine. You know, as few as maybe 20% of primary care physicians may have had experience and training and feel comfortable with the issue of sitting down and dealing with patients who are chronic smokers and who do have a nicotine addiction. I think that that's a very important bottleneck because most patients will seek out a family doctor as the initial contact person. But I think if you look at those two elements that we've already discussed, mm-hmm. you know, the ability to actually manage on a day-to-day patient these kinds of patients on the one hand, and the ability once you've developed a relationship, a therapeutic relationship, the ability to give them access to medical interventions that work is also very, very important. And I think just those two elements become, you know, very, very critical bottlenecks.
It seems to me, though, that if that was implemented, it wouldn't be very expensive at all to do. You know, from an overall, you know, when you look at the healthcare system from an overall global standpoint, you're not looking at major funding to allow people or to give people the opportunity to stop smoking.
You're absolutely right. I think what's kind of interesting for those of us on the healthcare side, it makes too much sense not to do it this way. And I think what a lot of us are realizing is that there are many challenges out there in the real world from at different levels, third-party payers, governments, organizations that are involved in the day-to-day management of communities. And so far, we haven't been able to coordinate our activities in such a way that patients are allowed to benefit in ways that the science tells us they can.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? What are the next steps that have to happen?
Well, I think that one of the nice things that's happened is that the federal government, I think, is doing some good work. Our lung associations are doing some great work. The federal tobacco control strategy has indicated a very strong desire that by 2011 that they want to cut the number of Canadians who smoke from about 19% of the population to about 12%. As we said earlier on, getting the number of teens smoking, cutting down that number dramatically. And I think one of the things we haven't talked about is there are about 37,000 people who die as a result of smoking, the direct effect of smoking. Mm-hmm. There's about 1,000 who die a year as a result of secondhand smoke. So another element of the control strategy is to reduce the effects of secondhand smoke. It's now become recognized as a real important factor in lung health, in respiratory health. And I think if we can make some meaningful inroads on those areas, I think we're on the right track.
Well, Dr. Durso, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to discuss not only the report, but also the sense of making resources and treatments available for people who want to stop smoking, who may not have either insurance plans that cover it, and certainly there are no government plans that really cover these medications. And that's something that really has to change.
It does, Barry. I agree with 100%. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. All the best.
Have a nice day.
Dr. Anthony Durso is a family physician and director of primary care lung clinic in Toronto. Coming up, a very interesting way to repair the retina from various diseases and damage. We'll get into that with Dr. Dongfeng Chen, associate scientist at Shepin's Eye Research Institute and Harvard Medical School. Coming up in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin.
You're listening to Dr. Barry Dworkin on Sunday House Call.